There was one day the head of growth was like raging through the office going like, who the f*** changed the profile layout? We're like, whoa, 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 what's going on? Why are you so upset? He's like, why am I so upset? He's like, friending is down 3%. And you're like, okay, well, all the buttons should be together. It just looks better that way. And he's like, oh, okay, it looks better that way. Great. Well, here's the thing. 3% less every day compounds. So I want you to go to Mark Zuckerberg's office and tell him why at the end of this year, instead of 378 million users on Facebook, we're actually going to have 260 million. And you tell him it's because you like all the fucking buttons all together.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. This week's episode is with Ben Blumenrose, who's a co-founder of Designer Fund, where he's invested in a lot of the design founders that you've heard from on this show, like Joran from Framer or Colin from Visual Electric. So the goal of this episode is really to tap in to Ben's perspective as a designer turned investor, to create a little bit of a blueprint for people who maybe you're interested in working at startups, or maybe you're even considering building a company for yourself. But before we get into all of that, I asked Ben to share a story about what it was like as one of the very earliest designers at Facebook.
Early 2007, that's when I joined. Pre-iPhone, MySpace was the social network du jour at the time. And if you were in college or you had friends in college, all of a sudden you noticed that they were using some other thing that was called the Facebook or Facebook. It had a Mark Zuckerberg production at the bottom. It looked undesigned, right? It looked almost like wireframes. When we started talking, I would say there were four or five designers and about 25, 30 engineers. That was the crux of the people building Facebook at the time, right? So the kind of responsibility you got as one of the few designers was typically like one designer would build profiles, another designer would build the Facebook platform, another would be newsfeed, another would be photos. You're probably working closely with seven or eight engineers on a number of different roles. And then that was your primary task, right? And then beyond that task was all the other things people wanted of designers. Marketing assets, t-shirts, like you name it. It was kind of a barter system internally. So that's the environment in 07 when I joined. My first project was helping with the Facebook platform, and it was around marketing the Facebook platform. How do we talk about this? What's the marketing site look like? All that stuff. And within a week or two of joining the company, I kind of said to myself, I have two goals here. One is I want a mental model in my head of how does this whole company work? Who's doing what? Who's responsible for what? Within like, you know, 6 to 9 months, I realized how foolish that was because it was changing so fast and we were hiring so fast. I'd go, hey, where's this person that was head of blah, blah, blah? And they're like, oh no, now that person's like responsible for this and this person's moved here. It was such musical chairs and things were growing and shifting so fast. But I actually had a goal of like, I want to know everyone at the company and I want to know like who's owning what. And then the third piece was, and for people who are heads of some area, could design be a lever for them? If you're a designer founder of something, whether it be an agency or a startup, you're always looking for where design can be a lever for whatever, sales, marketing, recruiting, et cetera. And so I was kind of curious because we had product design, you know, five product designers, and we had like a marketing designer, and that's it. And it's like, okay, well, how's the rest of this company doing design? You know, how's the sales team doing design? How's the marketing team? How's customer support doing design? HR, right? Like people are onboarding at this company constantly. What are the materials people get when they join the company? So basically within the first month, and I made sure I was doing my core work, but outside of the core work, I would email a head of X and I would say like, hey, you're running marketing. What would you do with design resources? Hey, you run customer support. What would you do with design resources? One, the email would be replied to within like 14 seconds. and you know, it's like, hey, I can give you a list and how soon can we meet? And are you offering? So that was really interesting. And B, once I met with folks, it was very clear that almost universally, if we gave folks design resources in some capacity, that it could be a big difference maker for that organization. So like one of the first things I did was ask the customer support team. So we had about 40 people, all of them recent grads from MIT, Stanford, Harvard, and they were almost like judge, jury, and executioner of all the things that were happening on Facebook. What are the things that are going wrong that I should surface? How do I resolve disputes between two users? How do I surface things to law enforcement? I mean, the stuff they were dealing with, I mean, you just cannot imagine. It's like managing, at the time it was a city, right? You know, 10, 15 million people. Hmm. So imagine 40 people that are straight out of college, and you have to manage a 15 million person, you know, the size of LA, and all the disputes that go with it. I just spent a day and I looked at what tools were they using to do this. And it was very clear within a few hours that they basically just had bad tools to do the job. So the software that they were doing their job was meant to be used by a single user, for one. So every setting that you would change for everyone,
Oh my God.
So it's like everyone had the same view of the thing. And then once you watched how they used it, it was just so easy to see how there were so many low-hanging fruit for product updates. So a couple of easy ones. One was like, we used to have this list of common responses. So the first person I sat with said, oh, okay, this person wants their account reinstated. Typically, I would use the common response for that. And then he looks over his shoulder and he says, but look, the common response we have is not good. And I've written my own and I keep it in this like text document and I just copy paste. And he goes, but I'm the only one that does it this way. I was like, oh, okay, cool. 20 minutes later, I go watch another woman doing her job and someone writes in with, I don't know, it was like a photo dispute. She's like, oh, it's a photo dispute. Okay, we have a common response for this. She looks over her shoulder and she goes, listen, our common responses are not good. Don't tell anyone about this, but I have this all these sticky notes and I just copy and paste from the sticky notes. And she's like, but don't tell anyone I do it this way because we're not supposed to do this. I was like, okay. Okay, two for two, interesting. And then I go to the third person, and sure enough, like one had a text edit, the other one had like whatever, some doc, online doc. Same thing. He's like, yeah, we have CRs. I have my own. I have my own. So much better. Like I've just seen it. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, man, are any of you talking to one another about like how you do your job and what's working and what isn't? And so instantly I was like, okay, if we rewrite this tool, one of the very simple things we need to do is let people write their own versions of common responses and also send up the chain anything that's improving. You know, it's like, hey, when I use this CR, fewer people write back, it resolves faster. So like the best practices should bubble to the top and everyone should be notified, right? Very simple stuff like that. Similarly, they would spend about 5 to 7 minutes when someone wrote in trying to understand that person's history. They would go through logs, go through their, you know, like, what did this person do? Did we da-da-da-da-da? And I'm thinking, my God, it's, and I'm like, what are you looking for? And they're just like, we're looking for like key moments in history. Was this person ever disabled? Were they reinstated? Da-da-da-da. And I'm like, oh, that's it? Those are like the key like things you're looking for? They're like, yeah. I'm like, okay, well, imagine if we just had icons for each one of these key things. And through a visual story, we could just show you like, you know, it's like this person's account was disabled, reinstated, reported for harassment, reinstated. They basically just show you through icons very quickly. And they're like, that would be incredible. That would save me an hour a day. And by the way, we ended up rewriting that tool, me and two engineers. It took us like 2 to 3 months. Once we turned it on, that new customer support tool doubled their productivity.
Wow.
So if you were a customer support agent and you could handle 100 or 150,000 users, you could now handle 300,000. And think of the business impact is how much do 40 people and their salaries, and right? So it's like you take 40 times 100, 120K, whatever, let's call it 4 million plus their benefits, 5 million. And now over in 2 months, we just created $5 million worth of value and reduced expenses by 5 million bucks, right? Let alone all the like cost of managing that people, the space, that you know. Right. So that's kind of the thinking like an owner mentality I was trying to bring to the table. And I think I brought that because I, in the previous job, I was an owner. And so I kind of understood how to approach it that way. And I just think too few times I just see too few designers thinking that way, even though they do have equity in the companies they work at when it's a startup, right?
So I'm in this Slack group with a bunch of really awesome designers, and there's this trend that I'm noticing. People are switching to Framer like crazy, and not just anyone. We're talking Joey Banks, Ryan Scott. I mean, like really, really good designers. And it makes sense because Framer feels a lot like Figma. So the learning curve is almost nothing, which is probably why Ryan said that building his new website felt like pure magic. So if you're ready to join us, head to dive.club/framer to get started. Okay, now onto the episode. Okay, so I could ask you about Facebook stuff for probably 4 or 5 hours, but really what I'd like to talk about is what you're doing now, because you're a co-founder of Designer Fund, and a big goal for me in this conversation is to tap into that perspective that you've kind of refined over the years as a designer turned investor. But before we get into like all of the weeds and everything, can you give us just a little bit of context for what Designer Fund is?
I had this experience at Facebook where with every year that passed, I just like fell deeper and deeper in love with the whole thing, with Facebook, with startups, with the impact we were having, with the impact design could have at a company, with engineers, with the idea of like people having equity in their company and what that does. And I just thought, my God, like what an incredible way of working and building companies and all this stuff. And the more I fell in love with Facebook and what we were doing, the more I got frustrated and angry about my design school upbringing. Because basically I was like, wait a second, I'm experiencing this thing. And it almost felt like I stumbled into it. You know, I was like, someone reached out to me and they're like, hey, come see this thing. And all of a sudden it's like, it opens your eyes. You're like, wait a second, this is the way. And why weren't we told about this? I studied at UCLA, so it's not that far away, right? A couple hundred miles, 300 miles. I was like, why weren't we told about this magical way of building companies and running companies and all this stuff? So it was like these two threads. One is like more excited and happy and amazed at like what we were building, and also more frustrated and angry that this was like this thing that was kept from us. And then another thing that was happening is I was starting to get more startups reaching out to me, asking me for design help, because all of a sudden, like Facebook gets successful. People are like, who are the leads of X? And let's see if they can help us. And here I was like, wait a second. I thought this was the magical Silicon Valley way of building things. And it was around year 3 or 4 where I was starting to find out, actually, no, this is a Facebook thing. And maybe a few other companies have it, but it's not a Silicon Valley thing by any means. And design is still largely an afterthought in Silicon Valley. By the way, the folks that are building in Silicon Valley now are building the future of the world. The healthcare companies that we're all going to require, the education companies that all our kids are going to and their teachers are going to rely on, right? The financial service companies that we're all going to need. All of a sudden, it dawns on me that designers are not part of the conversation. They're certainly not investing. And they're very often not on the receiving end. And the people who are receiving investments from Silicon Valley are often people who don't really value design. They kind of see design as a thing to, you know, like we can add later on, right? Whether that be make the product look a little nicer or some flashy marketing or whatever it is, it's like it's an add-on. And so that's what got me to start investigating Silicon Valley and investing, and what are the backgrounds of investors, and what does the ecosystem need if we want to move to a world where companies value design early on and bake it in early on. If that's the world you want to build, you're not going to be able to get that by staying at Facebook. So that was why we started Designer Fund, is because we have this vision of the world where the next generation of great companies value design and invest in design and use design to do right by people in society. And we could only do that by creating our own fund.
What do you believe about where design can make the biggest impact for startups that shapes the way that you craft an investment philosophy?
When we were starting out, it was kind of this belief that design was where value was created, that technology eventually gets commoditized. And basically, like, take any company or any problem and you layer design and it's going to be 5 times more valuable. And the reality and the way we've thought about it over the years, that's a more refined way of thinking about it, is that industries kind of go through this cycle. And I think we can look at AI as a way to look at the cycle. So when you start out, there's often like fundamental technology that needs to get invented, right? So in the terms of AI, it's like we have all these like LLMs and fundamental technology that just needs to make the thing work, right? And if the thing fundamentally doesn't work, no user experience that you layer on top of it matters. So another example is like Waymo. I was thinking about like things that if you live in San Francisco, you've maybe started to use these self-driving cars.
I just took my first one. It was quite an experience, actually.
Incredible, right? So, yeah. But the problem, so if the fundamental experience, like let's say you came in, beautiful, beautiful music plays, there's a nice little button. Hey, Michael, please buckle up. Great. Press the button when you're ready. Okay, great, I'm ready. boom, crash right into a tree within 3 seconds, right? It's like, okay, Mike, please exit the car, da, 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 you know? So the fundamental tech needs to work, right? And there's a lot of work that it happens when an industry is nascent where we build the fundamental technology. As that technology gets built, slowly the user experience layer is where the value accrues more and more. And so with AI, I always laugh, it's like with new industries, you can almost bet that the first UI that engineers are gonna use is the terminal, right? So basically it's, you know, whatever, 50 years old, 60 years old now, text input, blinking underline thing, waiting for you to like type something, right? So it's like, hey, we created this thing. It creates images automatically. How should I input what I want? Oh, write it down. You know, a room with a sunshine and blah, 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 and a candle looks sort of like this, right? It's so clear as day that that's when engineers own an industry, when it's a text input UI. Hmm. As the tech gets better and better, and we can argue whether an AI like the LLMs probably will, a lot of them will get commoditized and whatnot. But then the user experience layer is where a lot of the value is going to accrue to, right? So in the case of a product that helps you create marketing images as an example, you want to have a lot of control to create that image. And there's a reason why Photoshop doesn't work as a text input product or Figma, but actually it's let me create shapes and colors and put them where I want and define these things using a very sophisticated user interface, right? Because that gives me the control over the output. And right now we're in a space where with these AI tools, where a lot of the times you'll try to explain something to the tool and it gives you an output that's 80 or 90% of the way there. And then there's no refining. It's like, if it doesn't get there, okay, try to describe it a little differently or make like 10 of these. Maybe one of those will, I don't know, maybe one of those will be close to what you want, close enough, right? And it's just very clear that that's not the user the user experience that any of us want, right? So we're eventually going to see products that are very elegant in the way you input and modify and expand the things that you want AI to do for you, right? And the user experience layer is where that's going to shine. And then eventually industries get to a place where all of a sudden you have dozens of products that are well designed. This is kind of the mature phase of an industry. So like I would say like consumer social is probably in that place.
Yeah.
Where user experience, good user experience becomes de facto. At that point, like design becomes much harder of a difference maker for the product, right? So if you are gonna start a new consumer social product today, the bar for the user experience is super, super high, just to have table stakes. And then probably you have some other angle, distribution, some other like product. If you're going to do that, right, you're going to try to do some other thing with it, not just improve on the product experience. So for us as an investment thesis, what do we look for? We look for places where NPS is super low. People are really unhappy with the products and services that exist there. We love when there is an incumbent that people hate, right? Hey, there's a $20 billion company, everyone uses it, no one likes to use it, right? That's a place where if you bring a new user experience to that place, like you'll see a lot of value accrue to a company if they execute well. So that's kind of how we look at it, is basically where are spaces that are starting to mature, where user experience can create a very big delta and design can create a very big delta, and those are the spaces that we're constantly looking at.
Is there an example of a recent investment that you've made that can kind of paint the picture of that criteria?
I mean, sure. Yeah. Look at Visual Electric, right? Like I've looked at a lot of visual design creation tools. A lot of them are exactly what I described, a text input into the thing. Visual Electric does start with that. And my sense is eventually we're going to add other ways of inputting. What they do beautifully, though, is once you've created the first thing, the ability to modify and adapt and iterate feels much more like a design tool as opposed to this like image creation tool, right? And for designers, I think they instantly just gravitate towards a tool like this or like kind of that way of building. So that's an example where I just think it's very clear to me that these tools that we want to create image, you know, we want easier image creation, they're going to feel a lot more like a tool like Visual Electric and much less like a text box that just like pumps out an image and then you have to like write a text box again.
We had Colin on just a few episodes ago, so it's kind of interesting timing to see the other side of the table now with like the investor perspective.
Yeah.
You also were one of the early investors in Framer, and right. We had Jornan was one of the early episodes here. So can you tell that story too? Like, why did you invest in Framer, where, you know, that criteria wasn't exactly the same? So I'd be curious, like, how you evaluated the opportunity, what made you excited to partner with them, and then maybe just anything you want to share about, like, what that process was like, as, you know, a lot of the people listening probably haven't actually went through a fundraising round before.
So one other lens that we think about when we're investing in companies and people is basically, are these the people that have the ability to build the best in class product in this space? Kuhn and Jorn are like, you know, I worked with them at Facebook. They're second to none. Like, when it comes to building design tools and creative tools, if you basically told them, I'm not going to pay you anything, what are you going to spend the rest of your life on? They're still going to do that. They're still going to build and design, like, design tools. Like, they're just, it's like in their blood at this point, right? And so I love founders like that, where it's just like, they're obsessed with this thing and they're really, really good at building. Because when you're really, really good at building, it makes everything else easier, right? Sales become easy. Distribution becomes easier. It's not to say that it's for sure going to win. We have plenty of examples where the best products don't win because they get outmaneuvered through distribution or price or all these other things. But man, it makes everything else easy. So one thing is just like, okay, Kuhn and Jorn is starting a company in the design tool space. You know, you almost have to talk yourself out of that. So I'm almost already starting with a de facto, we'll write a check unless there's something scary or weird or whatever. Their thesis at the time was basically that prototyping was design, and that the idea that we would first start with kind of a visual design for a lot of the products and services that we build, and then take that into a prototyping tool, and then take that prototype and then turn it into a real thing. Their belief was just like, that's not the future of how we build products and services. And that designers would much rather just start with kind of building a thing you can play with and interact with. Having come out of Facebook, a place where a lot of the best builders and designers at Facebook kind of had this mentality where it's just like, just build the thing. It wasn't even prototyping. You know, we just thought it was like, build a rough version of the thing. Let me play with it. And then I can tell you if it's like good or not. Because Photoshop, it's just like, you can make anything look good in Photoshop. You can make it look, you know, kind of feel the way you want to feel, whatever. But it's like, until I get like real user data, and until I feel like the way it like goes from screen to screen, it's very hard to react to a thing. So we often at Facebook at the time, we would just like build the thing right out the gate. And so they said, like, if that was what the best people were doing, that's where the industry is going to go. And to me, that made a ton of sense. If we could do that, why wouldn't we, right? And that was enough for us to say, okay, like, someone's going to build the next Adobe. Why not them, right?
Okay, so let's talk to someone who's listening to this, and they have this desire internally to be the next Jorn Kuhn, create the next generational company.
Yeah.
Let's assume that they have some of the obvious boxes checked. Like, they have domain expertise. They understand and care deeply about a space. They have pinpointed a product that is addressable, but also has like a big enough TAM to get you excited. So what are some of the other things that a first-time founder could do on top of that baseline to get you to the point where you would be really excited to partner with them?
So there's a few archetypes of designer founders. One is kind of like, they're the craftspeople who want to build out of the gate, super elegant, super refined, kind of the highest quality MVP type product. And we see this, especially true for folks that have come from successful companies prior. They put so much weight on that V1 that they move too slow and they're too precious with it. So the first thing I look for with a designer founder that can build is like, show me the product that you've built. And ideally, as we start talking, you know, my favorite thing is like, you meet a designer founder on Monday and you go through the product and you say, hey, this looks amazing. But, you know, I really wish that onboarding worked a little bit like this. And then on Wednesday, they're like, hey, I was thinking about the two or three things you said. Here's like a couple iterations on what I built. Check this out and check this out. And to me, that's kind of the engine I'm looking for. It's like, how quickly do you take feedback, think about it, prototype on top of it, and ship and ship and ship and ship. That's a superpower, because when you think about someone who doesn't work that, who doesn't have that skill set, what I just described, that feedback comes on Monday and Wednesday, there's a new product experience. If you can't build, or if you're not the designer, right? It's like, oh, okay, that's interesting. Then we need to get a designer to mock it up. Then an engineer needs to like code the thing. Then the engineer and the designer need to hash it out. And that's if you're an engineer founder. And then there's a lot of founders who basically come from finance or domain expertise or whatever, who are reliant on some other people. And now they have to go convince the people to try this, right? It's like, so when you're that close to being able to manifest a new experience, it's a real powerful superpower. So I would say if you're a designer founder that can build, like lean into that and showcase your building abilities, showcase the speed at which you build. The other superpower a designer has is like the ability to manifest the future and make it feel real when it's not real. So I'll give you another like Facebook story. So like one of the things I did early on was work with the sales team. So we had a situation where one of our sales folks was going down to Microsoft to try to get them to agree to a deal where we would embed some Microsoft products within Facebook. And his challenge was to show them kind of what these things would look like inside of Facebook. As you can imagine, as someone with a background in sales, he was using PowerPoint, right? Like, hey, here's what like Microsoft Search would look like in Facebook, or here's like what Microsoft Ads would look like in Facebook. Whereas if you're a product designer, I can make that thing look so real. I can make it feel like that thing is already live and we just took a screenshot of it. So designers have the ability to, through being able to visually manifest mock-ups or marketing sites or prototypes, what that is it like that's showing the future, right? You have that ability. And so when I see, to me, it's like, use that superpower. Show me like, hey, here's what in 5 years, here's what this thing could look like. In 5 years, here's what the world looks like if we're successful. When I don't see that, and you're a designer founder, I'm just thinking, it's like, you're a designer founder and you send over a text memo. Like, why? I think it's good. Like, writing's important. Writing's a way of communication for sure. But man, there's so many ways that you can, on top of the writing, show, not tell. And so that's another thing I look for. And I think that is a special power that designers can have, is basically for investors manifesting, hey, here's what this thing could look like in the future. Here's what the ecosystem could look like. It's just much better effective communication if you have a designer on the founding team. And that should be evident. And then the thing that we also tell designers to understand is, where are your gaps? Because the thing is like, if you and I just wrote up all the things that a designer CEO or a designer founder needs to do, right? Accounting, sales, go to market, recruiting, legal, right? It's like, you can write them on a whiteboard. And there's probably like 40 areas like that. As a designer founder, there are areas where you have excellence in already, and you should lean into those strengths. Then there's areas where you think you can bring your unique point of view and you want to learn more about that. So let's say I want to make sure that we get the most talented people at this company. It's going to be a big focus of mine as a founder for the first 2 years to have like the highest talent density at this company, to get the best people here. And I want to understand what is moving the best people to decide what company they work at right now. And I'm going to bring my design superpower to that. I love that. Right. And so you, as a designer founder, think about what areas you want to learn and grow into and become excellent at, and then understand what are the areas where you're like, I'm not fucking touching that. Right. Legal, I don't know shit about it. I'm just going to hire like an incredible legal firm. I'm going to know enough to be dangerous. I don't need to bring my whole like design worldview to legal and redo our legal docs. And maybe we can have a different legal process and blah, blah, blah. Choose the areas that you're just going to outsource and have them be done good enough so that you can be excellent in the other areas. And that's really important, because I think oftentimes what we see is designers basically just have a total gap. They focus on product, they focus on marketing. They have gaps in things, distribution or price. You know, it's like, hey, how are you going to price the thing? I'm not really sure. It's like, okay, what are other products priced at? I'm not really sure. What? You're going into space. You don't know what everyone else is charging for the thing. Do you even know that the thing you're building is like, can you actually profitably make the product you're making? So I think there's things like that where oftentimes a designer founder, because we don't come from business and we don't come from these other areas, that could be real gaps. As designers, what do we love? Blank Figma files and, you know, blank Notion docs and the ability to create those. But, you know, give you a spreadsheet and it's not exactly like, hey, interpret this spreadsheet and what's working well and what isn't. It's like, for most designers, that's not how they want to spend a Tuesday morning, right? And so they just avoid it. And I think that it's like, you avoid it at your peril. because those things, if you get them wrong, can really kill a company. I would urge designers to understand all the different parts of what it takes to build a business and understand where you're going to be excellent, where you're not, and then get people, whether it be investors or partner, you know, you can get partner, like we outsource our accounting, we outsource our back office. And so find good people who can do that for you and don't spend spend the vast majority of your time on the other areas. And the last thing I'd say is like, where you're working right now is an excellent place to do a lot of that learning. I hear from a lot of designers that they're like, sales, ugh. Who wants to like spend time designing sales? Decks, who wants to design decks? You know, if your founder is going out to fundraise, then yeah, you should be designing some decks. You know what I mean? Or if sales aren't going, you should be like looking at like, why aren't sales moving, right? Is it product or is it just like the way you're talking about product, right? So again, that's the owner mentality, but like, it's such a great learning experience. Like if you're in a company that's 200, 300, 500 people, 50 people, make it a point to understand how all the different parts of that company work so that when it comes time to start your own, you're not just starting from scratch on that stuff. Like you actually have those people, and most of those people want to work with a designer. They're more than happy to show you and teach you and inform you on how these things work, especially if you're like, hey, maybe I can help you with design on some of these things, right? So like I said, it was a barter. There was almost like a barter system early at Facebook. And guess what? Like design was almost like gold in that barter system. So like take advantage of that.
Hey guys, real quick, if you know me, then you know I love products. So I want to take just 30 seconds to tell you about three of my favorites. Now, anytime that I'm designing and building a website, you better believe that I'm going to use Framer. I made the switch recently and I'm never going back. Now, once it's time to animate my designs and showcase my work, that's when I'm going to use Jitter. It's like Figma, only for motion design. And every step of the way, I'm going to be using Raycast constantly. It's the cornerstone of how I use my computer and the way that I stay in flow while I work. Now, I hand-selected Framer, Raycast, and Jitter to partner with me so that I could do these interviews full-time. So if you want to show them some love, it would mean a lot. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode.
It's interesting to hear you talk because in many ways, what you're kind of pointing to as an archetype is like you kind of have to be a generalist if you're going to be a founder because you have to wear a bunch of different hats. And so it's like, what is the core skill that you bring to the table? And the value of design as the core skill seems to be increasing pretty rapidly, especially even just like, I don't know about you, like I open up Twitter right now and my entire feed is just non-engineers building products that they couldn't previously do just based off of all of this new AI tooling. So the future feels quite bright.
One nuance that I think it is important actually, the design generalist. And not just design generalist, but more of a generalist period, like someone who's just curious about how a company works and all different pieces and what actually moves the needle for a company. That's more important in a designer founder that is the CEO. You don't have to be a designer founder and be CEO. And in fact, probably for a lot of designer founders, they'd be best served to not be the CEO. Because if you were like the designer founder head of product, right? You can way narrow your aperture.
Yeah.
And it might be just a way better fit for a lot of designers that to be able to just like, hey, I want to be the product overseer. Everyone has this architect, the hero of the CEO. And I think that, you know, you can be that, right? And I do think we celebrate, you know, the next generations like the Dylan Fields of the world and Brian Chesky and those guys. But you don't have to be. So I do think there's room for people who love the craft and want to stay in the craft and the design and the product to be a founder, but you don't have to be the CEO.
Okay, so let's talk to someone who maybe they don't know if they want to be the CEO yet, but they don't have a co-founder yet. So like right now they are going into this understanding the possibility for just maximum ownership. Something that I've noticed in talking to different investors is how excited they get to back second time founders just based off of all of the experience that they've already accumulated. So I'd like to unpack that a little bit as a way to help first-time founders avoid some of those more common pitfalls. How would you expect a second-time founder to approach an opportunity differently than a first-time founder?
Not that long ago, there we have a second-time founder we wrote a check into. We wrote a check for about 9 months ago, and he put together a memo. He's not a designer by background, but it's so clear that he's a second-time founder because as you're reading the memo, it's like every question that you start having in your head he like nips it at the butt. Like he just like anticipates and addresses it right away. Things around distribution, things around how we get our first few customers, things around when we get our first few customers, what's the cadence that we'll be working with them under, how long to work with them before we charge, how we think about pricing. And it's just there's a someone, they've gone through the paces, you know, and they've learned all the hard lessons and they address them before they get started. And so I do think like some people just learn on the job. As a first-time founder, they're learning a lot of those things that I just told you. But I really do think that if you are at a company, especially at a startup, you can learn a lot of those lessons now as a non-founder. You can basically use your time at that company to learn those lessons.
Can we go a little bit deeper on that? So like, what are some of the lessons or questions that a designer could be asking themselves right now as a way to put in kind of pseudo reps to prepare to be a founder?
Okay, let's say you are building, I'll just use like Visual Electric and Colin as an example. So you're building this tool. It's a, you know, visual design tool. There's other companies doing it. He can basically just spend all his time building the best in class product and hope that word of mouth and product quality wins the day. But the reality is that it probably won't. It'll help, but it probably won't. And so what I would expect from someone who's like a more seasoned founder, for example, for a product like this, is like distribution. How do we get this thing in front of as many people as possible, as quickly as possible? So how do you figure that out? Well, you should be talking to like people who are making images. So let's just take marketing images as an example. Who are all the people making marketing images as their day-to-day job? What are the workflows they're doing for those marketing images? And how do we make sure that Visual Electric is like top of mind when they're doing that? And there should be a whole strategy around making sure that we have partnerships for workflows. So like, you know, I'll give you like an example. This is not one I've talked to Colin about, but this is like an example of like, we use Contentful as our CMS at Designer Fund. We write a blog post, right? And we have a header image for each blog post. Before I publish a blog post, somehow I have to create a header image. Well, guess what? Contentful, once I've created a blog post, they can do one of three things. One is just ask me to upload an image. One is they could say, hey, we've actually created an image for you. And they could use some whatever, you know, API to some like auto image tool. Or another is like, hey, we have this embedded Visual Electric experience. Like based on your blog post, here's an example of an image. If you don't like it and want to modify, iterate, whatever, it's like embedded right here for you. So that's like one distribution example. There's probably dozens of these kinds of things that if you're a second time founder, you're out the gate thinking, if we build the best in class product, how do I get this in front of as many people as possible? How do I build the partnerships? How do I create word of mouth? How do I, you know, how do I get people to share these images? You know, how in the product do I get you to bring in other people from your team and make that easy? You know, one of the things that Figma did so well early on, the first few projects that we saw Figma coming to us from were these like people who were full-time employees at big companies who also freelanced, who were using Sketch for their full-time company, but using Figma for their freelance work. And so I would say, hey, you know, hey, we need this like image. Can you send me the Sketch? And they're like, oh, actually, I'm using this thing called Figma. Here's the link. And after that happened three times, I said to myself, oh man, this is going to be the future. Like,
that's
it's like,
good signal.
Oh dang. Yeah. Right. And so what was so good about Figma is they didn't put, if you're a freelancer and you're trying to like come up with a new way of working, if I charge you an arm and a leg for it, you probably won't adopt it. But if I let a freelancer use Figma for free and made it full featured, at a certain point, you're going to come back to your company and say like, what are we doing not using this thing? Right. And then you're going to bring it to your team. And then once your team starts using it, then Figma should be stepping in and say, hey, Google, guess what? 35 of your designers are already using Figma. You want to make sure it's secure, right? You want to make sure it has all the features that you probably want. Here's what that would cost. Knowing how you're going to run that process, knowing how, like, what are the features you want to keep on or turn off? What do you want to gatekeep? How do you want to, like, that usually comes with some sort of, you know, having gone through the grinder a little bit. Typically, someone that's just kind of been through it. And it's either someone that's been at early stage startups for a while and just been close to that, or someone that's tried their hand at a company and failed once or twice.
Before we move on, are there any other mindset shifts that you think designers would have to make in order to be a successful startup founder?
I think building something that people will pay for and thinking like a business, a lot of designers kind of think first around what would be like something someone will use. They want to build like fun, cool products. You know, like we get a lot of designers who want to like do travel apps. And so the question is, what's the business here, right? And I think too often designers basically just come at it from a, hey, we're going to build this product, we're going to explore, we'll see what happens. And they really aren't kind of like testing their thinking around what is the business around it. And you can really feel the difference when you get people who have like, who are fresh out of business school and they're just, or have just like a very finance oriented approach where they're just, they kind of drool at when they see like an obvious business opportunity where it's like, hey, these people are like, they're spending millions of dollars doing this archaic thing. And if we just like built this thing that was even like, you know, half as good as most products, like that's good enough. Like they don't really care about building. They just want like good enough that it's going to solve the problem for people who are spending all this money and time to do this thing so poorly. And so I think it's just very clear when you talk to people who are like really excited about these business opportunities, and designers could learn a lot from folks who look at the lens in that world. Where's money being wasted? Where are people paying too much for the value they get? And find those spaces as opposed to just like, in addition to, I would say, to spaces that have bad user experience.
I mean, a theme that's coming across in this conversation to me is just almost like a zooming out from just the UX and the product to be able to see the bigger picture. It kind of makes me want to ask you a little bit about how you think design education should evolve as someone that did have that kind of a background. And everything we're kind of talking about is like, you know, the impact that designers can have as founders and as builders. So what do you think has to change in the future for us to live in that kind of a world?
So I went to UCLA. They were very good about craft. You know, we hear a lot about craft these days. And I think everyone's all into craft, which, you know, craft is good. I'm going to challenge it a little bit. So in design school, we had a project where it was design a menu for a restaurant. Go find a restaurant, find some shitty menu, redesign it. And then what the professor would do was basically they would grade you on kind of very formally the improvements, readability. Did you like kind of cluster the right groupings, right? Appetizers, you know, the right appetizers or whatever. Was it hard to find desserts or what? You know, it's like a very formal way of assessing the menu. However, what didn't we do? We didn't go to a restaurant and say, look, you have a restaurant. How many people step through the door every night? 100. Okay, 150, whatever that number is. For you guys to be successful, how much does the average person need to spend? What's that dollar amount? Let's say it's $65. Okay, that's the business side. For people who walk through the door, when you're coming to this restaurant, what kind of experience are you looking to have? Are you looking for a quick in and out, or are you looking for like a full meal, right? And then basically take the user need and the business need, and then how do we design a menu that gives people an amazing dinner experience while at the same time making the restaurant really successful and make the top line work? What I just talked to you about was never even close to approached. We never talked about that, all right? And you extrapolate that with all sorts of, you know, a marketing site. Hey, can I see the title? Does the text make sense? Does it blah, 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 all this stuff. And I'll tell you an example that happened at Facebook to us. We had an experience where like there was one day the head of growth was like raging through the office going like, who the fuck changed the profile layout, right? And we're like, whoa, 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 what's going on? Why are you so upset? He's like, why am I so upset? He's like, friending is down 3%. And he's like, someone moved the add friend button from the right to the left or something like that. And basically like friending went down 3%. And you're like, okay, well, but that's like, you know, all the buttons should be together. Was the designer who did it was like, the buttons should all be together. It just looks better that way. And he's like, oh, okay. It looks better that way. Great. Well, here's the thing. 3% less every day compounds. So I want you to go to Mark Zuckerberg's office and tell him why at the end of this year, instead of 378 million users on Facebook, we're actually going to have 260 million. And you tell him it's because you like all the fucking buttons all together. We didn't have a good sense of kind of what is driving the core of this business. Like this business is not valuable at Facebook. If people are not using the thing, if people are not on it, if people are not friending each other and adding friends and bringing new people on, it doesn't work. And aesthetic be damned, like aesthetic should support that business goal. And so like that menu example is a very simple one, but it basically extrapolates to all sorts of design work and design output, where we look at the formal, and you see this on Dribbble all the time. Hey, what looks better, like this picture or this picture, this button or this book button? You know, it's like, you know what works better? The thing that makes the business more money, or the thing that is solving the goal of that page. Is the goal of that page to communicate something? Then make the title bigger. Is the goal to convert someone to start going into some flow? Then make sure they do that better. So like, don't ask people on Dribbble, like aesthetically, which one works A or B. It's like, you're solving a goal, and figure out which one fucking solves the goal better. So that's the thing. I think like in design education, we got very little of that. Like, yeah. How does the design actually not just support goals, but support more specifically business goals? Because oftentimes that's what design is oriented around, right? It's trying to solve a certain business goal. It's not art. Like, if you want to study art and if you want to do art, go do art. Design is not art. We can do some design that's art, but like, that's not the crux of why we all get paid. My teachers came from the art world. Like, they were literally artists and incredible artists in their own right. But when we try to take some of the fundamentals that they were teaching us to, like, you know, build stuff that would make money, they almost saw that as like cheapening the thing. You know, like, what are you doing? Yeah. Like, they almost saw that as like a bad word or something. So I think what I would love to see is more design schools embrace that mentality of like, how does design support business goals? How do we get more interaction between design and engineering and finance and the business schools? Almost universally, you will find that the design programs do not interface with like business programs.
Designers who come to the point where they realize, oh, I want to learn this set of skills, it feels like it's MBA or bust. Which right. is such a heavy-handed approach. Yes. It's like, no, we literally just need to help designers be able to understand even just the basic unit economics of the product that they're designing. Just that is like such a massive step change in what you're capable of as someone who can bring software to life.
Yes, 100%.
Okay, so we've talked about designers as builders, designers as founders. Let's bring it all the way full circle now. Why do you think that more designers should become investors?
So you follow the money, right? So you say to yourself, okay, if we want more companies that are wired this way, that have these sets of values, that are trying to like do right by users and society and user experience, how do we get that? We need founders to believe that investors are looking for that. And it so happens that the type of investors that value and look for that have a design background, right? Or should, or at least have seen the light, right? And so we are seeing a little bit more of that, where you see someone that came from product or engineering, but they've built product and they realize that good product and design really matter to certain spaces. They invest that way, where they're like, I want a team to spike on those in those areas, design and engineering. But certainly designer founders I've seen, like Kuhn and Yor now have a fund, and just look at the companies that they fund, right? It's basically like people who are wired the way they're wired. So now you have dozens of Kuhn and Yorns that Kuhn and Yorn are funding, right? And hopefully they do the same thing. And same thing, designer fund, who do we fund? Like people that look like that, or Dan Becker and Daniel Scriver, or Celia Cuervo, or all these designers turned investors basically create this signal that, hey, there's an investor class now that look for people like you and or people like this. And if we want to raise money from those people, we need to have an answer for that. Same way that most founders have an answer for market size and go to market and engineering, they should have an answer for like, why will this be an excellently designed product? Right? Why would this be the best in class product? And if we have more investors who have that as a gate, then more founders will value that and prioritize that. And guess what? You'll see more companies getting built that way. And so that's why we're really excited about trying to get more of the ecosystem to value design and trying to get more designers to realize that investing is not so scary. And that a lot of the tools and knowledge that they have is already right there for them to make some investments. And if we get more designers to become investors, I think we'll get more of the kinds of companies that are building the software that we all want, that are focused on the types of problems we want these companies to focus on.
Okay, so before I let you go, can you share a little bit more about the vision for Designer Fund, what you're working on right now to kind of address some of these, you know, shortcomings or opportunities to pull more designers into the market?
Our third fund is 2 years old, and for the last couple of years, we've experimented with this product called Designer Fund Partnership, which is basically our way of letting anyone apply for investing from Designer Fund. Typically, it's all referral-based, and what we've noticed is that if we create a moment in time, whether it's usually about a month, where we let anyone apply and give us a bunch of data about what they're building, it lets us assess very quickly and give people much quicker response, yes or no, or we want to know more about this thing. And it also gives access to capital to people who often have not had access to capital. So people who might not have a warm intro or whatever, it's like, we're going to look at everything the same, right, through this like application period. So that was this concept of a designer fund partnership that we've created. We've done it twice now. And I think when this episode comes out, we'll have already announced the third instantiation of this partnership product. And what's really great about what we're doing this time is we've actually invited about 16 designers who are amazing designer leaders in their own right, who also angel invest or advise companies formally. And those folks are also going to be looking at these applications, and you have the opportunity to be seen by these designer angels, and they can write a check alongside Designer Fund, or they can even write it independently. And this experience will also let us disseminate our diligence process to these 16 folks so they can see up close, what does it look like for a fund that's been doing this for 10 years? How do we assess stuff? So we can help them learn how to do this well. They can get a bunch of reps in. And once they learn, then hopefully they can teach other folks, or we can bring more people into the fold as well. So it's, you know, we talked about like, what's the future of design education and learning by doing? So it's like, how can we create more of these opportunities to learn by doing for the people who can really influence the ecosystem? So I'm really, really excited that, and hopeful that this isn't just a kind of a one and done, but is kind of laying the foundation for more designer angel investors, more designers turned investors to teach and learn from one another, to create more sharing of deals, sharing of opportunities, sharing best practices, and hopefully we can continue to expand the universe of folks that do this well.
Well, for anyone who's listening is interested, we'll definitely have a link in the show notes, and you can check out everything that Ben's doing with Designer Fund. Ben, thanks for coming on and just sharing what you've learned over these years. I mean, this is a fantastic step for people who are listening who, you know, do have some kind of interest or maybe have this idea that they're thinking about, or maybe they're wanting to get a little bit more into investing. I really appreciated your perspective, and thanks for taking the time today.
Amazing. Thank you for having me on. And yeah, look forward to seeing how people respond and any questions they have, but really appreciate the opportunity.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, if you want to go even deeper, each week I send an email out to over 10,000 designers with bonus resources and key takeaways from these conversations. So head to dive.club/email to sign up. Okay, I'll see you next week.